If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Too much testosterone over the years for me, I guess.
Yeah, not enough testosterone for me, apparently. Or too much dutasteride and finasteride.
You just need to get that Anarar voice, man.
My voice box has post-finasteride syndrome. For those who don't know, welcome back to the Gillette Health question and answer session, I guess. But I think everyone's familiar with David de Mesquita rhymes with cheetah. That's how John Meadows introduced you, right?
Yes. It's easy to remember that way.
Yeah.
Rather than mosquito.
Mm-hmm. We have a whole bunch of Derek characters that we mentioned here on the podcast. For example, More Plates, More Dates, Derek. But this is Accountant Derek, one of my best friends, and also happened to do a bodybuilding show. I have not done a bodybuilding show. In fact, yesterday, I was talking to Andrew Huberman, and I said, oh, yeah, I'm getting back into fitness because now my 3 kids are getting older and the wife and I are like doing fitness competitions. And he said something along the lines of, oh, the healthy ones or the unhealthy ones. It's like, well, it's I guess CrossFit's technically healthier than bodybuilding.
It depends on if you're talking about orthopedic surgeons or not.
Yeah. Well, if you're a bodybuilder, then you need like both orthopedic surgeons and the internal medicine or family medicine doctors.
Yeah. And therapists, too, for sure.
Yeah, probably so. Accountant Derek had a great question about muscle spasms and great questions about like suffering in bodybuilding prep and a separate question about gut health in prep. So maybe we start off with the muscle spasms, but what was up with those?
So I did one bodybuilding competition about 2 years ago, and leading into it, I basically cut down my water a lot for 2 days. And that whole day before the competition, every time I moved my leg at all, my entire quad would just go through these alien-like muscle spasms.
So those alien muscle spasms, leading up into that point, did you notice that the most annoying thing in the entire prep is how many times you dropped something?
Personally, no, but I also grew up clumsy, so maybe I'm just used to it.
Used to it. So one of the most annoying things that I ever experience in prep, and most people experience at some point in time, is that they keep dropping something to the ground, whether that's the fork, and then you get so tired of dropping it 5 times in a row that you just grab another fork, and hopefully you didn't drop that one too, because then you'll pick up another one after that. Usually it has to do with like misfiring of the actual muscles because your electrolyte imbalance is thrown off so much that it's not sending signals properly. The other thing that does happen in a bodybuilding shows that I see all the time is actually sometimes lower blood glucose. So it's electrolytes and blood glucose issues, and they send misfires and miss signals, and it creates like those rippling effects through the, for you as the legs. It's kind of annoying. It's cool. And then it becomes annoying after a while. You're like, oh, this is so cool. Like, I'm going to call my mom and let her know that like, I'm flexing a muscle I never knew that I could. And then all of a sudden it's like, all right, can it stop now? Please stop spasming. Please stop spasming. And it just gets worse and worse, especially if you're doing a water manipulation where you're dropping fluid into a show, which is a very, very common approach. And I actually did want to ask you a question on the water manipulation. So your water manipulation for your peak week, how did that go down?
So about a week out from the show, say 7 days until 2 days out, my coach had me drink exactly 1 gallon of water a day, which I typically probably drink 2 a day just on average because I'm basically like a camel. But then 2 days out, I basically went down to 0.5 gallon a day. And the day before, I had maybe 4 or 5 meals. And the first 4 meals, I got like 8 ounces of water. Then my last meal was like a refeed or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. I went to Five Guys, had to get a burger and salty fries, no water until the next morning.
So how much water did you have the next morning? I'm actually curious.
I had 6 ounces of black coffee.
Okay.
And nothing until after prejudging.
Sure. So I'm sure that you're very flat by the time you went to stage. The unique thing about peaking that I found over time is, one, don't drop water down into a show, at least like maybe not until you need it manipulated. So if someone is drinking, even this could be a 100-pound bikini athlete, no joke. And if they're drinking a gallon of fluid a day, whatever their natural intake is, about 10 to 14 days out from a show, usually it's around like 7 to 10 days out that I do this manipulation. I'm like, okay, how much water have you been drinking in a day? Usually I have a rough number because I give a preset, but not everyone hits that preset because you also don't want people to be becoming OCD with their tendencies, even though you want them to be very surgical with what they're doing, but not too surgical or else they're going to get burnt out and start missing variables. So I'll ask, how much water are you drinking in a day? And if it's a gallon of water, for instance, right? The first thing I'll do is I will increase fluid, not reduce fluid. Why am I going to increase fluid? Well, the first thing it's going to do is, especially if someone is natural or even enhanced, you're going to get a flushing factor because it's going to start increasing diuresis, which is a natural diuretic hormone where you're going to start flushing out water. If someone's enhanced, it's even more important because it will start to reduce down angiotensin, which drives up blood pressure, and it can get them into a more parasympathetic state where they're actually urinating rather than holding fluid. When you pull fluid, you tend to hold fluid, because the body gets used to whatever that number is. So if you increase fluid, well, now you can actually pull down the fluid into the show and you can keep the body urinating as you're going in rather than holding fluid and getting either angiotensin to get driven up and blood pressure, which is a lot of reasons why people get headaches going into a show, is just so much fluid gets pulled. And you start to get flat and stringy because you also need the fluid to shuttle glycogen into the muscle tissue as well as sodium. So if you don't have enough fluid, you're not really going to be shuttling. The other major issue that I see with too much fluid being reduced is that we're going to be talking about gastrointestinal issues. The number one thing that I've seen in with my own peaks directly as an athlete, as well as other athletes going to show, is when fluid gets pulled down too much, you start getting slowing of the gastromotility. So you're not going to be having bowel movements anymore. So how are you going to get bowel movements to move? And that was the solution that I figured out a long time ago. I really like magnesium to, at least if you're pulling fluid down, you're still adding some fluid into the intestinal tract where you can still have at least maybe looser bowels, or maybe even have to, this is kind of weird, but maybe even diarrhea, but it's way better than holding fecal matter because that could be pounds of fluid that you're just holding in your system, as well as your waste starts bloating out. So I always increase fluid. And then if I need to pull down fluid, I pull down fluid, but sometimes increasing fluid tightens someone down so much just by pulling down blood pressure and getting the bowels moving better. And then you start pulling down the cardio and things like that to reduce down stress load on the body rather than increasing stress load into a show.
Gotcha.
Is that even worse with athletes on GLP-1s?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my last prep, I actually did GLP-1. This is way before they were popular. And my question was, is what dose actually impacted not only gastric motility, but also a reduction in appetite? Because that's what I was really interested in. Like, how can you take an edge off of a prep? And everyone's like, oh, bodybuilding has to be so hardcore. It's like, well, if you have tools to make it smoother, why not? And I found that 0.1 milligrams is plenty effective for actually starting to reduce down appetite, which is way lower than a medical dose. And leading into the show, I actually dropped out my GLP-1 because my gastric motility, I did notice reduced down. I went up to 0.2 leading into the show, and then I dropped from 0.2 down to 0 2 weeks out because I needed to half-life out because I knew I was squeezing down into a weight cap. And when I needed to fill back out, I didn't want my gastric emptying to be slowed down at all. And I know that it slowed down going into that show. So I dropped it out 2 weeks out from the show because I did not want any slowing, especially since I was going to have to be loading so much with food. So I do think that GLP-1s either need to stay very, very low dose, like a 0.1 milligram kind of thing, unless if you know that things aren't slowing down, because some people don't really get too much slowing of the gastric tract. Other people get a ton, like I got a ton, but I also have bacterial overgrowth going into that show. So there were some other variables coming in. The issue that I had though, and this is what people don't talk about, when you come off of GLP-1s, the dopaminic urgency to eat food goes up. And I'm someone that you can starve to an oblivion. I can eat the air and I'm fine going into a show. with the GLP-1 coming into the mix and having the reduction of appetite, when I removed it, I was wanting to eat the world.
And were you on LDN?
No, I was not on LDN to that show, actually. LDN may have actually, I don't even know if that would have had an impact. The issue is when you're eating such low food, I don't even know if LDN would have made a massive impact on like appetite at all, to be honest. But the GLP-1 did. Mm-hmm. GLP-1 blunted it really hard. And then when I removed it, it was the only time that I've actually had severe cravings. And I'd probably say the cravings were really bad for like 48 hours. And I got used to probably maybe either the dopamine or the ghrelin, one of the two. I don't know if it spiked ghrelin up. It very well may have. But it was more of dopamine, I think, that was like I was wanting to eat food. And I was like, no. Like trying to silence it again. And
I assume you were not on ibutamorin or ipamorelin or any other ghrelin analog?
No, I was not on a ghrelin analog. I was on growth hormone, which can obviously have somewhat of an impact. Yeah. But I dropped it actually at the same time as the GLP-1. So that, again, would have been like half-lifing out. So I don't think that there would have been crossplay there.
You mentioned that suffering doesn't have to be normal. Mm-hmm. But when you were in your prep, one of our nurse practitioners in the office over saw you get out of your car to come into the office for work. And they were concerned because you were moving so slowly. They thought, did something happen? You know, did you have a mini stroke? But how do you tell the difference between, I guess, tell David more about just the amount of suffering that you went through and maybe discern the difference between suffering and just something being difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I feel like, you know, definitely everyone's body is different, and I was pretty good about just taking orders and following them. So I got a plan from the coach. I basically followed it, and it was very just a set meal plan. I did it, and the first, you know, it was a 13-week prep. The first, say, you know, 7-8 weeks were okay. The last 4 to 5 weeks was just torture. I mean, I would not stop thinking about food. I was extremely hungry. And I, as Kyle mentioned, just had no energy whatsoever. You know, I was working 2 jobs at the time, have 2 kids, had to do these workouts, cardio, it was a lot. And, you know, when I would tell my coach these things, I didn't necessarily get any change to the plan, even in terms of hunger, no like high volume, low calorie food. Nothing, just basically like, hey, you look great, keep going. I'd be like, all right. And that was all of the support I got.
So when it came to suffering, because suffering is a pretty deep and also, I say, almost intimate word to an extent. Maybe that's the wrong word that I'm picking there. But it is, state of suffering is a state of illness. And we're going to jump into this in a second. But when you say suffering, why do you feel like you were suffering? And then I'm going to tell you my opinion on what bodybuilding should be versus what it's commonly viewed as.
So the last few weeks, I literally was waking up in the night because my stomach hurt so bad from being hungry. And then I had just no energy. Like, I don't know how I got through the day, honestly.
Okay. So this is where things get pretty unique, because suffering is a really common term used in bodybuilding when people are getting ready for a show. Like, if you're not suffering, you're not getting ready. And to be honest, I'm going to just go really deep with it for a second. If you don't have like cancer and illness and like on like dying, that is suffering in my opinion. Why I'm making this metaphor and allusion is because you should not suffer into a bodybuilding show. You should not be in a state of illness. You should be relatively healthy, but tired. Like if you're tired and hungry, that is normal. And that's what I try to tell people. Tired and hungry is relatively normal. And again, there's things like GLP-1s that take an edge off it. Like, why not? That's a great tool. And it reduces down and silences out some of those voices to help people into a show. I do think that someone should do a bodybuilding show without a tool like that in the beginning, just so that they understand that it is just a voice that you can silence to your own ability. And then you can add in things to take some of the edges off of it as time goes on. I would say that I suffered, and I would use the term suffering, into shows where I was doing like, there was one show where I was doing zero carbs, zero fats. Like I'm talking like straight up when they actually had true weight isolate, where it was protein, no carbs, no fat in it. I was doing 200 grams of protein for 2 months straight into a show to try to make weight cap. Obviously, like you go into gluconeogenesis where you're not going to drop weight. You're just going to hold on to everything. So it made it way harder to get in shape. And I had no issues doing that, but it was a state of suffering that I was in. It was a state of illness. I mean, I lost pigmentation to my skin trying to make weight cap for that show. In fact, T3 levels went up very high, and I was actually kind of lucky that it did this, but it gave me diarrhea, which is kind of a normal thing with high dose of T3, which looking back on what I have now, it's probably not a great choice. If for anyone actually like super, I mean, it was high doses. It was like 125 micrograms kind of high.
Wow. Yeah. I generally don't like T3 to be higher than 10% of total thyroid dose for those who need thyroid replacement.
I agree with that.
10 to 1 is the physiologic ratio for most people.
Yep, I do agree with that. I would say it's a little bit different going into a bodybuilding show. The ratios, just because of reverse T3 and the high stress levels, and plus most people in the bodybuilding space do have poor guts unless they're actually with someone that's taking care of their gut or monitoring their health on the way. But again, like suffering like was like a normal thing for me. I finally had a show with John Meadows, and it was the first time that I actually felt good. I was eating 70 grams of carbs, which is super low for most people. And I was eating with 7 grams of non-trace fats added into it. It was half a tablespoon of coconut oil. So eight grams. And I felt good. Like I was crushing PRs. And now it was weird because I could not pick up, by the end of that prep, I couldn't pick up 20 pounds. Like anything above 20 pounds, I couldn't lift off the rack. But you give me 120 pounds in my hands and I'm repping that thing out. And that was a really unique state to be. So I could perform when I needed to perform, whether it was in my job, whether it was in my personal life. I would say the only thing that I couldn't perform in was, way TMI, you guys, sex. That you become like a Ken doll, basically, where nothing exists down there unless if you're going to the bathroom, basically. And if you're going to the bathroom, you're like, oh, thank you. So
that's because of the prep or because maybe once in your life you took a finasteride pill?
I didn't care about my hair back then, man.
That was just a bad joke.
I'm left with like hardly any hair now. I feel like balding is becoming a trend nowadays because TRT is a thing.
Yeah. I mean, you can always do what Chris Bumstead did. I think he did a podcast where he said he wished that he started finasteride or dutasteride earlier.
I will say that even though on paper, finasteride and dutasteride should not have a negative impact on bodybuilding gear, it definitely has an impact. I've seen it over and over again.
Mentally, it has a huge impact. So it's a thing to talk about with your physician, of course, as is any of these peptides or medications. Yeah. And I guess I could play devil's advocate. And obviously, there's downsides to GLP-1s and this and that. But I guess for the purposes of this conversation, like focusing on suffering versus difficulty, it seemed to me that you at least were in some degree of state of illness. Oh. But your mindset was, you know, I can do this. If you give me a plan, I can do it. And it's temporary.
Right.
But then the issue comes when, you know, you've done one show and maybe if it was way easier, you'd do two. But then again, because you did it with like very minimal to no assistance for your first show, it's probably a good thing that you're not doing show after show after show, right? Well, maybe not for bodybuilding coaches making their careers, but from like your health standpoint, you're probably healthier because of it.
Yeah. I mean, I know that I didn't feel healthy in the last few weeks, so.
No one would be healthy. Well, actually, so I take that back. I've seen some of the best lab work in my entire like 10,000 sets of labs that I've seen by this point in my life. Some of the best labs I've ever seen have been some of my athletes like 2 to 4 weeks out from show, which by the way, I'm mind blown because I was not expecting to see good labs.
Sure.
I've seen some of the best labs actually not close to shows. And that's really interesting to me because that's not normal, by the way, you guys. It just, I've seen it. It's like, I've seen people that look like they're not on gear that are straight up on gear. Women and men, actually, which is super unique. You shouldn't be sick going into a show. You should be tired and hungry, and that is normal. Just mustering up courage for 5 minutes to get out of a car just to make sure that you're not going to end up on the ground because it takes a lot more energy to stand back up again. That could actually be a normal thing. And I'd say like the last 4 weeks of a prep get pretty hard. Every 2 weeks in a prep, this is a general rule of thumb that I found. Every 2 weeks in a prep, you kind of hit a wall and it probably starts at 8 weeks out. The first wall that's hard to hit is like 6 weeks out. You hit a pretty hard wall and then your body gets adjusted to it from a psychological standpoint and a physical standpoint. And you start getting number and number. And this is where it's super unique is, I don't know if you experience this, and this is a question for you too. I always found that you get more in touch with your spiritual being when you're getting ready for a show. I don't know if it's a sense of like starvation or whatever it is, and it's creating like neurotransmitter differences, but you become so numb from a physical standpoint, from like the actual physical pain that you're actually kind of going through, and you just get used to it and you numb it out and blank it out and just keep doing that. Like you start having talks with like the big man upstairs. Like I remember like my 2 a.m. talks and 3 a.m. talks, like sitting on the toilet, like also asking to hopefully go to the bathroom kind of thing. But getting in touch with your spiritual side. Did you experience that?
No, but I'm already pretty religious and in touch. So I think maybe for me, it's just a normal state.
Sure.
Yeah. I've heard from dozens of people that when they approach a body fat percentage they haven't been at in a while, whether it's high or low, they start to have memories of back when they were that similar body fat percentage. For a lot of guys, it's, you know, mid-adolescence. They remember things and have similar thoughts when they were 14 and they were extremely lean. So I think there has something to do with the adipose brain axis and probably just how your nervous system functions in general. But I know that, you know, you pray quite a bit and, you know, you think about spiritual things quite often. And also, you know, you're a swimmer. So you haven't been like as shredded as during your bodybuilding show, but you never really bulk up. In fact, probably during your bulk, that was probably the highest body fat percentage that you've been in a long time. Because I'm curious about your bulk and your cut too, because it seems like you kind of had gut health issues that were different during the bulk and then during the cut.
Yeah. For me, you know, I think during the cut, I didn't have too many gut issues, but during the bulk, I did. So with my bodybuilding prep, I basically kind of was bulking on my own. Then I got a coach and I bulked with him for 2 to 3 months before the cut. And when I was doing my own bulk, I was still eating kind of my normal diet, just more, but mostly, you know, whole foods, healthy, you know, chicken, rice, broccoli, sweet potatoes, that kind of stuff. And then at night, kind of some more fun stuff like peanut butter and jellies and stuff, just get extra calories.
Sure.
And lots of veggies with fiber. So then when I started with my coach, he completely changed my diet. A lot less veggies, a lot less fiber. You know, went from like having oatmeal every day to white rice, for instance.
Okay.
I had potatoes once a day still, but much less veggies. So I was like, hey, I don't think this diet's working for me. I'm putting on weight, not necessarily a good weight, but is there something we can change? The only thing we changed is he told me to add I'm blanking on it.
Digestive enzyme?
A digestive enzyme before my meals, which did not help.
Which one?
He said any of them would work. Maybe I chose the wrong one. I don't know. But yeah, that was pretty unpleasant. And then once I started my cut and we cut back calories drastically, within a week, my digestive system was completely normal again.
Yeah. So you said a few, I think, key points. One, putting on fat to put on fat in the off season is not muscle tissue. That's like rule number one is all my athletes stay pretty lean year round. One, they stay healthier. Two, they feel better in their own skin too, from like a psychology standpoint. That also can aid in relationship health too. So secondhand. So, and then the next thing that you said, so I don't like athletes just to put on fat for no reason. I just don't think it's needed. Yeah, you need to be in a surplus, but your surplus doesn't have to be super high. Some people do need surpluses that are higher, especially like if androgens are involved, you can handle more food usually. Your utilization goes up. I also don't think that your protein needs to be super high. Is one major issue that people do in the bulk because your other food gets so high that I'd rather leverage like glycogen and carbohydrates as a fuel source and then reduce down the protein so that you're not getting digestive distress from having too much protein, because that's also going to create bacteria. So when you went from that high fiber diet, which is obviously going to help with motility and stuff like that, unless if it's too high, it will back you up. But for you, obviously, that was your equilibrium. When you change that equilibrium, what happened was you've removed the prebiotics that you're getting from all those vegetables that you're having. And that was the major culprit to probably causing that diarrhea, is not only did you have the reduction in fiber, which is binding for you and helping to move things subtly, but you also remove the prebiotics, which are most important for the development of pro and postbiotics. And everyone tries to say like, oh yeah, I just take probiotics. Well, usually the best thing is a well-balanced diet. And the reason is the prebiotics that you're getting from the fibers. And when that was removed, and then also you're removing the sweet potatoes, which is high in fiber again, That's also going to create another issue where now you're not getting micronutrients that you're originally getting, which I am a fan of jasmine rice. Jasmine rice digests very well, and that's like a staple for almost everyone. But also, again, when you're talking about heart disease in men, I want oats in a diet. If someone can digest oats well, which not everyone can, then oats are going to be in a diet because oat B is an amazing fiber for cholesterol. So when that gets removed, you throw out the microbiome. So that's probably where the runs are coming from. And then all of a sudden you start reducing down food and now you're getting less diarrhea. Well, you're eating less food. So one, you're not going to be passing as much. And then two, you're also not probably building up as much bacteria in your system. So that's a lot of the reason why people say my digestion's really bad and they start a prep and all of a sudden their digestion's so much better. Well, you're eating less food. So you're probably having less inflammation in the intestines, less bacteria growth, all those other things. But that doesn't mean that you don't have a lot of opportunistic or bad bacteria that was built up in the off season. That's not going anywhere when you start dieting down. It might be getting starved to a certain extent because you're not feeding it anymore. But I promise you, when you come out of that prep and you start to eat food again, your digestion is going to immediately start getting worse again. It might feel better, but usually people will like bloat and hold a bunch of water retention, not only just from cutting off water, going into a show, which not everyone has to do. Some people I have drinking 2 gallons of fluid on the day of show, but the ones that do, they tend to have fluid retention there, as well as now you're eating a bunch of sugary foods because you're like, oh, I can eat food. Let's get some like dessert and stuff like that. And then you start eating too much because you get that dopamine rush from the sugar. And you start growing bacteria too fast. And guess what? You had a lot of bad bacteria that you had to begin with. And now you're feeding that bacteria again because you're not starving it. And then your digestion gets really bad out of prep. And then people are like, oh, it'll normalize. And it does to a certain extent because now you have more good bacteria again to balance the bad. But you're still left with a lot of opportunistic bacteria that probably needs to be addressed in the off season before even leading into another show. So that was a long answer. But it's a very common trend that I see is like, digestion's okay, or certainly somewhat okay. Like if you didn't change your diet, it would have been remaining okay. And then you remove it or digestion gets bad and then you remove the food and all of a sudden it gets better. You're like, oh, my digestion's great. Well, no, you're just starving the bacteria at that point. So there's just less food going through your system, less inflammation.
I like the analogy about probiotics not being the best way to manage your gut because dumping probiotics into that microbial niche or environmental niche is not how you tend a healthy environmental niche. Just like if you have a fish tank or a terrarium, you're not going to just dump in new good fish all the time. You want to have the right environment of fish food and mixes and the right postbiotics or other things to help actually maintain that environment. So I think that's a good analogy. I suppose if you don't have any other questions about your prep, I did hear an influencer doctor say something at one point, which I'm interested in your opinion of. Obviously, there's a lot of genetic and hormonal determinations of what body fat percentage people gain the most muscle with. And some people might gain the most muscle at 10%, 15%, whatever the case may be. Maybe if you're an extremely hard gainer, maybe closer to 20%. But I heard this influencers say for average genetics, males tend to gain muscle best. Like let's say there's a male and they want to gain as much muscle as possible. And if they're complaining about not getting enough muscle or their bulk is just not as successful, then the first thing to try is to try to get to around 9% body fat or higher on an in-body or bioimpedance, or about 14 or 15% on a DEXA scan. Otherwise, they haven't tried hard enough.
That's a weird statement.
It is a weird statement.
So
I wonder who made that.
I don't know, but I can talk from my personal experience. I do find that most men, general thumb, at least in a bodybuilding space or an athletic space in general, right? Mm-hmm. Because like I've been an athlete in multiple different sports at high levels and worked with athletes in a plethora of different sports at professional mm-hmm. levels. Most men around 12% body fat to 10% body fat, maximum 14% body fat. That's like their sweet spot. Mm-hmm. When I was
on a DEXA or like on an in-body?
In-body, I don't even care about it. I don't even count it. Like InBodies are so inaccurate. So I actually get frustrated when I see a screenshot of an InBody sent to me in a check-in. I was like, please don't ever send me that again. Because they're getting obsessed with bad data is the issue. And then all of a sudden they're trying to perfect data. It's almost like the constant blood glucose monitoring when they were doing the studies on it. And they found out that people were like trying to skew the markers to try to make their insulin levels as effective as possible and their blood glucose levels as effective as possible. And they made things worse. It's the same thing with like obsessing over the data. Sometimes I literally try to keep it stupid simple. KISS. Send me the information. Don't think.
Sure.
And I hope that everyone has someone that they can do that with where they don't have to think. That's why, like, sometimes I'm working with people like PhDs or MDs and stuff like that. It's because, like, they don't want to have to think. They want someone to trust that they can just give them information to, just like you. I can just give you information, but I'm still going to think. That's my flaw. But I will, there's a point in time where I'm just like, hey, here's the information. You speak. I'm gonna stop talking. Right. And that's really where it should be because everyone's a little bit different. Where that statement, okay, 12% body fat, I think, is a sweet spot. Very few people can maintain 10% body fat comfortably year round. That is a genetic anomaly, in my opinion. Between 8 to 10% body fat year round is a genetic anomaly.
You have to be like a Thomas DeLauer or Nick Baer or someone like that.
I 100% agree. Because if someone's getting, like, let's say, naturally 10,000 to 12,000 steps in a day, not even just from a genetic standpoint, they're pretty active. They're probably going to be sitting around that 10%, 12% marker pretty easily. 12%.
Cameron can do that too, can't he? Yeah.
And I used to be able to when I was playing soccer and I was 135 pounds. That was my comfort zone, right? Like I got used to that. And then I went to the whole you're not trying hard enough statement where it's like, okay, well, it turned out that I had Graves' disease. Yeah. So I have hyperthyroidism. And I was eating 10,000 calories a day. People thought I was like full of it when I would make that statement. Now it actually makes sense, right? My maintenance calories in the off season was at lowest. The lowest off season I ever had for maintenance was 5,500 calories. That's where I'd start my cuts. And 6,500 calories is where I needed to be to bulk. And usually it was between 6,500 calories on TRT. Mm-hmm. And then enhance, I was usually teetering up towards the 7,000, 8,000 calorie marker. And my body fat, I probably say the max body fat percentage I ever got to, because it did turn out I was a mesomorph. I thought I was a hard gainer. I was a mesomorph though, was 16%, I'd say. Mm-hmm. And I'd say at 16%, I was less effective in the gym and I was getting blood pressure rises and things like that, that I didn't need to have happen. Mm-hmm. If I just stayed closer to the 12% to 14% range, which I think is a sweet spot for growing muscle tissue on a DEXA scan.
By sweet spot, do you mean you have the highest velocity of muscle growth, the most muscle like per pound of just total weight gained? Or do you mean past that, it's not necessarily helpful to grow more muscle? So I guess is it for some people that are not having health issues, is it reasonable to bulk to 16%, even 18% for some people?
I would recommend against it because you're just going to put on excess body fat that you're going to have to either take off afterwards. And I just haven't seen it to speed up the rate at which people are actually accruing lean tissue. Mm-hmm. I just don't see it. It's more of the actual calories in versus calories out scale, where I think that you need to be in a slight surplus. And some people can handle higher surpluses where you're looking at from a composition standpoint. It's like, okay, cool. Like I like that body fat percentage standpoint. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure that you're only putting on like 0.1, 0.2 pounds per week kind of thing. And people think that they're going to be putting on pounds of muscle tissue a month. Enhanced athletes, especially the more advanced you get. So natural, if you're getting newbie gains.
Natural hard gainer often does have to bulk to, you know, 16, 17, 18%.
That's where I started my bodybuilding journey. But I went from 135 to 220 in 3 years, which is obviously kind
not,
of
not healthy.
No. Well, so I sold a six pack at 220 though. So I don't know how I just didn't store body fat there.
Yeah.
But if I could take back time, I probably would have ended up around like more that 190 to 200 pound marker. Mm-hmm. Like I cut down for a show from 220 down and I ended at 183. I probably ended my cut. I was probably 9% body fat or so. The issue is I accrued so much fat during that time that I wish I never did, because that's going to be on me for the rest of my life. Anytime I put on body fat again, where is it going to go? The love handles, right? Because that's where most of us are going to store it. The other thing is knowing what I know now is looking at the hormonal balances, even when you're a natural athlete, and trying to optimize that process, blood sugar levels, All those things matter. And if you're putting on excess amounts of body fat and becoming insulin resistant is the last thing you want to do for performance. And again, that blood pressure, carrying more weight on your heart makes you perform so much worse. And people push in the bodybuilding space androgens, right? And then they're getting blood pressure rises and they're putting on all this excess weight. And I'm like, well, is it a PED if you're not enhancing your performance? Like if you're actually not performing better, if you're not getting stronger, is it actually enhancing your performance or is it detrimental?
Still, yeah, still a PED, but maybe you're just a non-responder. But I think that's good info as well. And maybe that's a good place to end the question and answer regarding your bodybuilding prep. But yeah, even for naturals like me that are just on TRT and HCG, still really good, still good info to go over. So hopefully people have been able to glean a lot. But yeah, this would be a good series to continue. I guess we could call it fitness and bodybuilding question and answer and consult an expert when something goes wrong. So let us know any comments in the section below.
I do have a question for you though, and I guess you guys can answer this too. If you're taking more testosterone because it's natural, does that make you more natural?
Because testosterone is a natural and bioidentical molecule, and I guess HCG is too.
That's right.
Then, yeah, I guess it makes you natural and pregnant both.
Right.
Yeah, because HCG is the pregnancy hormone.
Yeah, pee on it, the luteinizing hormone.
Yep.
That's how you know if your HCG is fake or not.
Yeah. Interesting thing that I learned actually relatively recently, I think probably James taught me this or something, but brand name Pregnol is true human chorionic gonadotropin and does pop positive on a urine pregnancy test, whether it's like a thin layer liquid chromatography, the strip that you pee on. It will make, if it has HCG in it, Pregnol will do that, but Avadril will not.
Interesting.
Because it is slightly different.
I did not anyways, know that.
Not many people on Avadril. Most people are on HCG or Pregnol, which would be positive. And you also see that's positive in a blood test.
Yeah. So back in the day, we would do like when you didn't have money for labs, essentially, the way that you knew your growth hormone was real or your HCG was real is pregnancy strip is one of them for the HCG. And the growth hormone, blood glucose monitor, see if your blood glucose is climbing or not. Yeah. And that's a cheap way to know if it was like real or not, because there was so much fake and there's about to be a lot of fake you guys out there. So if you guys want some fake gear, go ahead and get it from China right now because it's not coming in from China.
Yeah. Unless it was just vasopressin or unless it was just glucagon. Could have been glucagon.
Could be glucagon. Could have also been potentially like they used to put HCG, I think, in for the growth hormone back in the day when they were making fake growth hormone. Anti-diuretic hormones.
Yeah, good question though. Let us know your comments below. Hopefully people have enjoyed this segment. And thank you everyone for their time and may God bless you with health and happiness.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.